Are in chapter 25, right at the beginning. It is pound on page Kuf Lamed Ches, which would also be corresponding on the top numbers 275. This is a famous letter whereby the Alter Rebbe explains the concept of anger, and it goes on for quite a long time. So it's not just such some little simple metaphor, mnemonic, whatever the word I'm thinking of over here. It's just a long letter. Well, Lahavin Imre Bina Mashikasa Besefer HaNikra Tzivos Rivosh. To understand the words of understanding, which is called in the book of called the Last Will of the Baal Shem Tov. Okay, and the Alter Rebbe refers to it more as Imre Bina, rather than Tzivos HaRivosh, because he says right here, Hagam Shebe Emes Einet Tzivosa, it's not a last will. V'loy Tziva Klal, he didn't do it at all. Livnei Paterasa, he didn't put the book together at all. Rakheim Lakuti Amarasa HaTahirim Shalakta Lakuti Basa Lakuti. But rather, there was a whole bunch of students who heard the various statements of the Baal Shem Tov, and they gathered them, and they were gleaned and re-gleaned, and finally put into a book, which is available published by Kahas, called Tzivos HaRivosh, and in English it's called The Last Will of the and Testament of the Baal Shem Tov. It's in English. V'lo yedei l'kavan aleshon al miskavanosei, ach mikavan hu emes l'amitei. The problem is that the Baal Shem Tov spoke in Yiddish, and the book is written in Hebrew. So right away, right there, if they would have just said what he said in Yiddish, so then we'd be able to understand what it is that he means. But whenever you're going to translate from any language, you're going to lose nuance. It just has to be, because there is no exact translation. Especially in Hebrew, when you're translating into Hebrew, you're going to lose a lot of nuance, because Hebrew is just basically 220 shorashim and built up from there, and you have to take it so that one word that you're translating, you could have several words being translated as the same thing in Hebrew.
Well, yes, it's such a rich language too.
Yes.
With meanings that we don't have anywhere else.
Right.
Yeah.
But they tried their best. And we kind of get the gist of we do get a very good gist, more than just a gist. I mean, these are statements that the Baal Shem Tov did say. So what is it that which one it is talking about? This one's actually quite later on in the book. I think it's like on page 120 or something like that. And I'm not really sure why this one statement bothers the Alter Rebbe. No one talks about why is it that the Alter Rebbe decided to write an explanation of this statement, which is not, I mean, it's a known statement. This is a statement that comes all over the place. His Maimer is Al Kol HaKayis Ki Ilo Eivor Avodah Zarah. It says that anybody who gets angry is though they are serving idols. So we've talked about this before, that and he says it here in not a few words, but the basic reason why it is that a person gets angry is because things are not going the way they want them to go. And what does it mean that they're not going the way they want them to go? As my grandmother would say, un ver bist du, who are you that things should go the way things that you want them to go? Things are going the way that Hashem wants them to go. So if a person is saying, I'm angry because things are not going the way I want them to go, so he's forgetting totally about Hashem. He's more concerned and wrapped up with himself. So what is the idol that he's worshiping is himself. So that's why they say that anybody gets angry as though he worships idols. And it says back in Geras HaTshuva, I believe one of the things over there, I don't remember the numbers on the top of my head, but I think he says anybody who gets angry has to fast 52 times. Is one of those things that the Arizal says in Shari Tshuva, how to erase the stain on one's soul for getting angry. So what we want to do, and we talked about this before, is it's not that we want to control your anger. You know, you have all different types of tricks. You can count to 10. You could just go out for a walk, move yourself in a situation. So what that's doing is, now that I'm angry, what am I doing about it? Okay, but that's not, this is before that. It says, well, why are you angry? If you're angry, it means things are not going the way you want them to go. You shouldn't be thinking, a person should not be thinking that things should be going the way I want them to go.
What's the difference between the emotion welling up and the overwrought feeling of anger? I mean, you get that feeling.
I don't think there is a difference.
Because it's hard. That is really hard to control the id. The id that's you. The anger feeling comes, and you have to. I can work on it. I can stay calm, and I might even go outside. I might even deal with it as soon as it comes in my head and remember that Shankar's
right.
world.
Right. So all those things are.
It's
yes.
Too late?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, in other words, there's such a thing called anger management, which means that the person got angry, and rather than screaming and yelling and having a tantrum and throwing things and kicking things and possibly doing great bodily harm to somebody, so then we tell this person, go do something to cool off. Okay? Well, ideally what we would like is that the person doesn't let it bother them.
Well, that's what I'm asking. Really, you got it in your head.
You
got to
get it beforehand. It's like, this happened. Okay. It's a shkacha pratis. There's nothing I can do about the fact that this happened already. I will now just have to deal with the situation the way it is right now. Okay? The emotion of anger doesn't help the situation now. There's very few exceptions to this rule. But for example, if a person is about to do something which is going to be dangerous, okay, you can yell and scream and jump up and down and show anger that, hey, don't do that, you're going to get killed. You know, that's okay, that's fine. Okay, and it does say also, I mean, we know, for example, that with Moshe got angry once in Chumash. And that was on the day of the consecration of the Mishkan, at the sin offering of the people, which was offered on the behalf of the people. The chatas that was supposed to be eaten by Aaron and his sons was burned completely on the altar.
Oh, wow.
And Moshe lost it on them. You're supposed to, this is, you know, what do you want? You know, you're supposed to do things properly over here. We have a manual that says how you're supposed to do this, and this thing's you were supposed to eat. Okay? So Aaron says, it just so happens that we're mourners, and a mourner's not allowed to eat a sacrifice, because our Nadav and Avihu had already died. But how did Aaron know that a mourner is not allowed to eat a sacrifice?
Moshe
taught him, exactly.
Yeah.
So what happened with Moshe? It says that the anger, the fact that he got angry, caused his memory to fade. And I've asked neuropsychiatrists about this. People are like, really know about brains. And it says it's very possible that when a person gets angry, there's all kinds of chemicals which are released into the brain, and they can have a physiological effect on the brain, these chemicals. And one of the side products or byproducts of these chemicals being present in the brain could be memory loss. Okay, because what happens when a person gets angry, what the brain does at this point is it goes into survival mode. It says, there's a situation over here now, I have to protect myself. And therefore, one of the things I'm going to use to protect myself is I'm going to forget this thing that got me angry to begin with. That's a protection mode that the body says, I got to do this to survive. So it's a chemical thing. Yeah, it's like, you know. So
I remember someone telling me it was receptors when you get angry, or when you're fight or flight.
Yeah.
It's not that you forget anything. It's you filter.
Yeah.
Your body's ignoring anything that isn't related to flight or fight.
Correct.
And so it just
Moshe forgot.
Over. Right. His filter was off.
Yeah. Moshe forgot. Vatam moven liyedi bina. This is understood to those people who understand with understanding. Lafuchsia, but hey, so anybody, like, if you just stopped and thought about this for just a half a second, this is not rocket science. Lafuchsia, but ace casa nistalka memeno hamuna. When a person is angry, they are now missing belief in God. That's how he says it, very succinctly. Ki ilo hayamamin shema'a shema'es Hashem ha'isa zois. Because if he would automatically just say, oh, it's hashgacha pratis, lo hayakas b'chalal, then he would never gotten angry. Now, Jews, they're not into turning the other cheek. That's not us. That's a different religion. Okay, so somebody does something to you. Normal situations would say that you get angry at that person. Judaism says, no, you don't get angry at that person. If it's a suable offense, you sue the guy. You go to Beis Din. You handle things according to the way the guys of Torah. The Torah already says about what you're supposed to do. And to hit a person, it says, Hayadayim Yaday Esav. Hands are for Esav, not for Jews. Jews use their mouths, that's what it says. So the idea of retaliation or revenge, these are all things that are all developed from the anger, and it's not purposeful. Just like worry, for example, is not purposeful. It doesn't help dealing with the situation of a person's worrying. There's a situation that needs to be dealt with. There are steps that have to be taken and so therefore, go take the steps to rectify the situation. And if you can't take any steps to rectify the situation, it's totally completely out of your control, then worrying is totally counterproductive because you can't do anything about it anyway. So why, you know, worrying is for sure not. So it's the same thing also with anger. Okay, there are steps that need to be taken. And if a person is angry, they're not going to be able to do the right thing because they're so caught up in this emotion that what they're really supposed to be doing and how they're supposed to be reacting to rectify a situation is not getting done. It's only making the situation worse.
We say you have to have a clear head.
Yeah.
And a clear head can't be emotional.
Yeah. It says here as an example, so you have a person. The person has free choice. And that person who has free choice curses the guy, or hits the guy, or breaks something of the guy. So that person then has to go to a Beis Din, or Hashem is going to do get him, and it's all because of his bad choice. He's the one who made the bad choice. Do you have to make a bad choice because he made a bad choice? No. So because he made a bad choice, so there's repercussions for his making the bad choice. As he says, he's going to have to pay money, he's going to have something in a Beis Din, Hashem is going to get him back if there's no Beis Din involved with it, because he did this to this person, which the person would warrant to think I should be getting angry at this person for doing this to me. So no, don't get angry. Do what the Torah says. Afal pikein al nizek kvar nigzar min hashamayim. Why shouldn't the person get angry? It's already been decreed in heaven that this was supposed to happen to them. It's already from before Bereshis Bara that a certain time, such and such was going to happen to person X.
There's the Rambam's 13 principles. One of them is, you know, that you believe the complete faith that Hashem is the ultimate judge. Only Hashem will take
attention. Post facto, yes.
The whole thing is like
This is the simple line when people go, oh, hashgacha pratis. But again, hashgacha pratis doesn't take that person who did this wrong off the hook, because he says, yeshar b'shluchim amakim. That person has free choice. And that person put himself in a position to choose to be the messenger for Hashem. That which happened to Reuven is supposed to happen to Reuven. But who said Shimon was supposed to do it?
Shimon's still on the hook.
Shimon still's culpable for his actions.
I think it's so important that it was in the 13 principles.
Yeah. I mean, it's supposed to be, this person's supposed to get hurt. So he could have tripped over his own feet and fallen. But no, Shimon decided, I'm going to be the one who's going to do it. I'm going to hit the guy. Okay, so therefore what? Shimon has to pay up. Shimon has to suffer consequences. That's what he says, Harbish Lukalamakim. Okay, so he says, even if you want to say, like in every instance of something being doing wrong, and however bad it might be, people, it's a very hard thing. Talking about the Holocaust. 6 million people died in the Holocaust, and a lot more people died in the Holocaust that weren't Jewish. Not one person died any sooner than they were supposed to have died. Because it says in the Gemara, 40 days before a person's born, it's decided when is the person going to die. So all those people who died from 1938 through 1946 were supposed to die at exactly the moment that they died. It was the free choice of those people who murdered them that caused them to die at that time. Was it a perfect example? Is you have World War I. Okay, 25 million people died from 1914 to 1919 during World War I. Okay? In 1920, there was a swine flu that killed 50 million people. So evidently the war didn't kill enough people. And people decided, listen, we're going to stop fighting with each other at this point. And Hashem said, well, listen, there's still another 2 more years of people that need to die. So what happened? Okay, people are being good. They're not killing each other. Fine, good. We'll have viruses and nothing, no medications to kill the virus. So 25 million people in 4 years of World War II, 50 million people in 2 years of swine flu after World War I, and two years afterwards, 50 million people.
It's a good example. Swine flu doesn't go to the heavenly court.
No, exactly. That's a shliach l'makim.
Wow.
Okay? And just like it was that those people who died in 1920 of flu had no choice about their dying, so too also the person in 1917 who got shot in Germany also had no choice. That's when they were supposed to go. V'loid el, and furthermore, afilu b'shazu mam shemakehu mekalali. At the time that this person has decided to hit the other guy, that Shimon decided to hit Reuven, or curse Reuven, mislavish b'keach Hashem v'ruach pivius baruch hamachayehu mekaymai. At that moment, Hashem is creating the person the way Hashem wants him to be creating him. So what is it? This is one of those things where you have hashkacha pratis and bechira chafshis, divine providence and free choice, clashing. Because right now, this person decided he's going to hit, Shimon decided he's going to hit Reuven. So at the moment that Shimon is hitting Reuven, Hashem is creating Shimon to hit Reuven. Because we believe, we learned already in Shar Yochid V'Amuna, that the world is that the creation is an ongoing process, mm-hmm. which is happening continually, and there's the divine intervention, which divine intervention is translated, the godliness which is enclosed in the world at any given second, is the divine providence. So for Shimon, it's Bechira Chafshis. For Reuven, it's Hashkacha Pratis. Okay, there's no clashing there at all. Because Shimon has taken upon himself to put himself in that position. Okay, we know this also from the Torah. The Torah says, for example, you have to build a mica, a fence around your roof, so that the fallen person doesn't fall off your roof. The guy's called, he's not called a person. It's called a neifel. The fallen one shouldn't fall off your roof. This guy could fall off a cliff. This guy could fall in front of a bus. Okay, you put up a fence so he doesn't fall off of your roof. Fall, he's going to fall. You don't have to be the one to facilitate his falling.
Liability protection. So that when Shimon hits Reuven, Hashem gave Shimon the choices. Shimon picked, and Hashem created both possibilities.
Correct. Hashem created an infinite number of possibilities for Shimon and an infinite number of possibilities for Reuven. And the Bechira Chashis of Shimon was put into that place where he decided to act the way he's going to decide. And Hashem's not stopping him. Hashem's saying, okay, if you want to do it, give them to hate. This guy needs to get done. You're going to do it. Fine. Hybrid Shluchim Lamakam. There's lots of messengers. I got lots of ways of doing it. Reuven's going to get what he's going to get. And okay, so you're volunteering. I'm taking your volunteering. This is enthusiasm will be exploited. Hashem's going to say, fine, you want to put yourself into that position. Okay, but you can't say, I didn't have a choice. There are people that want to say that, for example, you have people have a propensity towards doing something wrong. You can't say, well, this is the way I was created. Hashem created me this way, and therefore I'm doing this thing wrong. Because there's a forensic psychiatrist in Texas who did an extensive work on the brains of people who had been executed in Texas. Okay? And she found a very specific pathology to people who were executed because they were serial killers. And came with the conclusion that these people really had no choice in what they were doing. It was the abnormalities of the brain that was causing them to do it. Okay? These people had abnormal sized brains, something or another's, and therefore they had a propensity to kill. Average normal person, the thought of killing somebody is revolting, reviling, totally upsetting, unthinkable, not going to happen. But this person, they get off on it. Why? He could say, don't put me in jail. I have this propensity to it. It's a natural thing. I didn't choose this to be born with this abnormality in my brain. And therefore, you know, there shouldn't be any consequences. Baloney.
Baloney. Does take away free will.
Okay, baloney. Okay, where's the fallacy of her research? Is how many people who have that abnormality aren't serial killers?
She didn't see their brains.
She didn't look at them. You know, there's a statement that says, when I first introduced the fallacies, the whole concept of how you can make a statement. What's the problem? Why are there criminals? The reason why there are criminals is because of tomatoes. Because if you look at in prison population, you will see that 99% of the prisoner population ate tomatoes sometime during their lives.
It's oxygen too.
Yeah, exactly. Breathing. Okay, so breathing. So it's that the fallacy is well, how many people didn't eat that ate tomatoes didn't commit crimes? So we have no. So you can't say even if a person says I like doing such and such. Okay, a pyromaniac has an attraction, an unnatural attraction to fire. Good, gives them to hate. Let him go watch fireworks. That he should set things on fire? No. Okay, and same thing also. And anything that is going to involve any type of a prohibition, you can't say, well, it's just the way I was made. Because everybody likes doing the wrong thing. I mean, it's just if we had the opportunity and there was no consequences for any of our actions, we'd all be vildachayas. But we know there's consequences for our actions, and therefore we're going to behave in a very specific way. Okay, meaning if you say that there's no longer anything that's called wrong. Okay, we don't do things because of right and wrong. I know the difference between right and wrong. But if we suddenly say, okay, there's no such thing as anything wrong, everything goes.
That's scary.
Okay, so people are going to act like vildachayas. That was the whole premise of, what was it called, Lord of the Flies, if you remember that book way back when.
It was a different movie where people can do anything they want one night and they can even murder. Uh-huh. And it's okay, that one night.
Okay.
It's scary because you don't want to stay in your house and hide.
Yeah, anyway, Lord of the Flies. I'm not sure if it was based on a true thing or not, but what they did is the English took a bunch of people during World War II, a bunch of kids, and stuck them on an island with no adult supervision. Mm-hmm. And they turned into wild little animals. Okay? But now Hashem is creating that person right that moment that they're hitting, Shimon is hitting Reuven. K'moshe kasev ki Hashem amar loy kalel. It says that Hashem said to him to curse him. That's a story, if you know the story, with Shimi ben Gera and David HaMelech, I'm not sure which Shmuel. Is the instance. It's in Shmuel Aleph. And he came. David HaMelech was coming back from a campaign, and Shimi ben Gera on the way to the campaign was cursing him, on the way back from the campaign was cursing him. And David HaMelech on his deathbed told Shlomo HaMelech, oh, and by the way, one of the first things you should do as king is execute Shimi ben Gera. Okay? So it says Hashem made him curse him. Does that mean that he's not coupled? You curse a king? Cursing a king is a capital offense.
What's really cooks my noodle is that David wouldn't let anyone hurt him.
At the time he was alive because he'd done a favor.
The whole time he was alive.
Yeah.
He protected him.
Yeah.
So it cooked my noodle. Like, now he wants him to. Why did he have to have Shlomo do it when he couldn't change? Why didn't he just trust Hashem to do it? Is it because he was king?
He didn't want to look vindictive, and he didn't want. And Shimi, I think, did do a favor to him, correct?
Yeah.
So he said, okay, you don't pay back a Kara Satov by killing somebody. He did do something good for me. So, but for Shlomo Melech. To Shlomo Melech, he said, listen, this guy cursed your father. So take care of him. He didn't do anything good for Shlomo.
Right.
Where did Hashem tell him? Shimi was not a prophet. It says Hashem told him to curse. But you look in Tanakh, Shimi ben Ger is not a Navi. He's not. No, Hashem's not talking to him. So where does it say that Hashem told him to curse? It says that it fell into his thought. And he felt it in his heart. And that feeling that fell into his heart, you know, I really think I should curse David HaMelech. He could have stopped right there. It says, especially it says when it fell into his heart. Jews believe in this thing called Hamayach Shalat Al Halev. It's a major tenet of every philosophy around the world. And more so, Lahavdil, in Judaism, and more so among Hasidic philosophy, that the brain rules over the heart. You want to do something. Yeah, so... The control brain yourself.
Can rule over the heart.
The brain supposed to rule over the heart.
That is
our goal. The brain is to rule the heart. Okay, animals do whatever they want to do.
They might
without consequences. There's no whatever. Yeah, there's no consequences there. They're not thinking consequences. I want to do this. I'm doing this. People have to take it one step further. If I do this, what's going to happen then? So this thought fell into his head, into his heart. That came from Hashem Baruch Piv. Hamachaya kol tzavam, hachaya rucha shel Shimi mashash shedibur devarim elu leDavid. And that was when Shimi was Ben Gera was speaking and saying these words to David HaMelech. Hashem was enlivening Shimi Ben Gera at that specific moment, in that specific way, saying those specific words. So Shimi was allowing himself for the godliness to come through him in such a way that it was manifest as a curse to David. He could have said, oh, by the way, I'm not doing that. And if David needed to be cursed, it would have happened some other way. Had it been that Hashem at that moment had decided, I don't want King David to be cursed, and had stopped creating Shimi ben Gera at that moment, or had created Shimi ben Gera in another way, David HaMelech would not have been cursed. So you're going to have to say that Hashem wanted that David HaMelech should be cursed.
Or he created, or Shimi decided, I'm not cursing a king, no matter.
Yeah.
And I'm going to I'm not going to do
right, it. So that would have meant that Hashem was creating him not cursing a king. Okay? We're at the brackets now. V'zeo ki Hashem amar loy be'ez ha'hi mamrish kolol es David. This is what it means that Hashem actually said to Shimi ben Gera to curse David. U'mi yer malo, who said it to him? K'noy de mashakosav ha'bal shem tev zal. This is a parenthetical statement that goes on for, I want to say, a long time. I believe up until the middle of the 2 pages from now. It's all a parenthetical note. And he talks about what is Hashgacha Pratis at this point.
It's a good point.
It's a good example, because I thought, I know Shimmy has
It could actually be that it goes all the way up to Kuf Mem, is where the...
what do you call the jiffy? Atomic measure of time. A jiffy is like a billion,
Four times 10 to the minus negative 24, 26. So
every jiffy, Hashem is creating a new potentiality of creation. And
exactly.
Shimmy could have had an infinite number of thoughts and choices.
Okay, so now
it's a good time to break off.
We'll get to the matters of hand probably in 2 weeks. We're in the brackets for a couple of weeks. So just remember now, we're talking about anger, okay? Because the next 2 weeks, we're not going to talk about anger.
But it's all in spirit. It's for anger
As it's known that which the Baal Shem Tov writes, Al Pasuk Lo'elam Hashem Dvarach Anitza B'Shamayim. The Alter Rebbe quoted this already. This is pretty close to word for word. It's a, not a word for word. It's a synopsis of chapters 1 and 2 of Shar Yechud V'Amunah. Okay, and he says that he's quoting the Alter Rebbe always when he quotes this statement. I explain him La'olam Dvarach Hashem, La'olam Hashem Dvarach Anitza B'Shamayim. He always quotes it as a statement from the Baal Shem Tov. When it says it in Medrash Telem, the Baal Shem Tov did quote it, but the Baal Shem Tov quoted Medrash Telem. Okay, it was like you can say the Baal Shem Tov said in Medrash Telem that it says such and such, whereas the Alter Rebbe just says the Baal Shem Tov said. Because like this, the Alter Rebbe is paying homage to his teacher and his teacher's teacher by saying that it came from them. And we do say, listen, David HaMelech, when he said, Lo'ilam Hashem Dvarts of Nisha B'Shamayim, that Hashem has to be constantly creating the world, there were still people who came up with other definitions of Hashgacha Pratis than that of the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov's definition of Hashgacha Pratis is the most simplest basic definition of Hashgacha Pratis. That every single micron, every single quantum unit is governed by Hashem creating it that way. Whether that be quantum time, quantum space, whatever it is, Hashem is making it that way according to whatever Hashem's plan is. That's what the Baal Shem Tov says. You get into other statements like the Rambam and the Ramban and Sadia Gaon and all these other people who are writing, what does it mean that Jews have Bechira Chavshis, because it says in the Gemara, Jews have Bechira Chavshis, and animals, for example, don't, and where's the Hashgacha Pratis? And so the Rambam, for example, says that there's something called Hashgachas Amin, that Hashem decided there's going to be so many cows at the end of the year. But Hashem doesn't care about this cow or that cow. Just at the end of the year, there's going to be a certain number of cows in the world. Okay, that type of a statement, not that I'm taking anything away from the Rambam. Rambam was a whole lot smarter than Herschel Feynman. But it takes away from Hashem's omnipotence to say such a thing. Hashem is not involved what's going on with this specific cow. This cow happened to fall to get killed by happenstance. So what does happenstance mean? That Hashem is not in control? So what kind of almighty is Hashem not in control of? But this is what happens if you sit and you start analyzing Hashgachas Amin or Hashgacha Klalis, which the Alter Rebbe quotes in chapter 7 of Egeres of Shar Yechud V'Amunah, that the Baal Shem, Vilna Gaon came up with the idea that there's Hashgacha Klalis, that Hashem put everything in motion, kind of took a step back.
That's Aristotle.
Yeah, that's Aristotelian. But the Baal Shem Tov based his on a mistranslation of an Arizal that says that Hashem was nistalik. Hashem removed himself, is how he translates.
The Baal Shem Tov?
The Vilna Gaon, excuse me. The Vilna Gaon said that Hashem was nistalik. They're quoting the Rizal, that the Makom HaPanai, the first step in the creation process, was called Histalkus, that Hashem removed himself. And so he, the Vilna Gaon, translated that Kipshutai, that Hashem's not in the space that's occupied by the world. He's all out there. And he kind of like put everything in motion, introduced a little bit of godliness into the world, and said, okay, you're on your own. But doesn't answer the question, what about Leisa Sirponim Mene? It says in the Zohar, there's no place void of Hashem. How could there be a void to begin with? Okay, so all these other philosophies, all these other interpretations of what, how our lives work, and freedom of choice and divine providence, or whatever it happens to be, that God's involvement in the world, don't make any sense. Because there's just too many questions that can't be answered. So, but with the Baal Shem Tov's version of it, Hashem is creating this thing exactly the way it's supposed to be created right this second. Everything, every micron and molecule and a single unit of time is being created this way, and this is what Hashem wants. This is the way it's supposed to be created. And into that, we interject just a little tiny bit of our own freedom of choice. Because he said before, he said it over here, he said it twice already, Hashem is creating this person to be in that place doing that thing. And if Hashem would say, I don't want you being my shliach.
It won't be.
It won't be.
This reminds me of someone told me it's a very poor analogy, so forgive it, but imagine the super best crazed supercomputer playing chess against you, and it can analyze everything a billion times over, a billion times a second.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing you're going to do is going to, it can account for every eventuality that you could come up with.
Right.
And that's a horrible,
it's a bad example.
Simplest example of what Hashem does.
I mean, Hashem knows, and Hashem isn't interfering with what you're deciding to do. But Hashem could make it that you're not there.
That's it.
As I tell people right now, it's a prohibition to eat ham. Okay? One of the 365 prohibitions. Right now, at this very second, could you choose not to eat a ham sandwich?
Yes.
Nope. You can't.
It's not here.
There's no ham sandwich. Why is there no ham sandwich? Divine providence. It's divine providence that, first of all, it's my free choice that I didn't buy ham sandwich, but it's divine providence that nobody came by, stopped by, put a package down on the table, and left and said, I'll be back in a couple hours. And there's a ham sandwich sitting on my table. And now you want to eat it.
That
didn't happen. That didn't happen.
Yeah.
Okay, so there is no ham sandwich here, so you have no choice if you're going to eat a ham sandwich or not. Hashem doesn't want you to make that choice. That's that famous story that the Rebbe and, I've told this story before, it's a long story. A guy wanted to marry a non-Jew and he went to different rabbis and they all told him all kinds of songs and dances and he didn't buy it, and so the Shliach told him to go to the Rebbe, and he went to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe said, he said, Rebbe, I want to become frum, but I want to marry a non-Jew. So the Rebbe said, I'm jealous of you. He says, you're jealous of me, Rebbe? He says, yeah. It says, obviously, Hashem puts you in this situation because you can handle that situation. The divine providence has put you in a situation where, you're having an opportunity to become religious, and you have this woman who you want to marry. So the Rebbe said, Hashem didn't put me in a situation like that. That means I can't handle this situation. I wouldn't make the decision, the right decision. I won't have the strength to make the right choice. Therefore, Hashem didn't put me in that situation. Hashem puts you in this situation because you have the free choice to make the right decision.
Okay.
Finished. Okay? This story has been like zipping around the world since it happened. And I hear stories. There was an article in Beis Mashiach last week. Somebody told the story. And somebody was sitting there. And they decided, okay, I'm going to stop. I'm going to break it off with my shiksa. And so then that got told that so-and-so decided that he's not going to be involved with the shiksa anymore. So and the person said, oh, I heard this story. He's got the same like name as me, and the shiksa has the same name as her. I'm also going to break it off. Okay? And it hurts like there was like this story like kept on growing. Every time someone would tell it, and they would say about it to other two people that had it. So a third person said, I'm going to break it off too. You know, so because evidently Hashem gives a lot of Jewish men the strength to overcome marrying a Shiksa. Yes. Okay. So how much free choice do we have? Just a real tiny little bit. It's only the freedom, the choices that we are free to make are the choices that Hashem is allowing us to make. And that's all. Okay? Which is not a whole, you have this whole big sea of divine providence, and you have this little tiny bubble floating on the surface, which is your freedom of choice.
I feel worse on Yom Kippur now than I normally would.
It's a sea of choice. Okay, we're calling it a sea because what's the sea doing in this little bubble? It's slashing it back and forth, and waves are pushing it here and pushing it there and capsizing it and overcoming it, and this little thing is always floating to the top because that's what this little bubble does. It's a little capsule that keeps him contained in his own freedom of choice, but he's only getting as much free choice as Hashem wants him to have. So he says, now what does the Baal Shem Tov say? Shitziref oisiyah shenivra behen ha-shamayim humaymar yirikia, that the combination of letters which were used in uttering the expression let there be a firmament, let there be space, that godliness that Hashem exerted to bring the heaven into existence is constantly being renewed in that form to keep the heaven in existence. And not like Aristotle, who denies the whole idea of divine intervention. They do it very righteously. Their logic is logic. Mm-hmm. Hashem is infinite. The world is finite. Hashem is too big to put himself into this world and worry about every little specific detail. Hashem is out there. So what is Hashem doing? Is Hashem got the whole thing spinning? And anything else after that? So that's what's happening by itself. Hashem's sitting back and watching it. Okay, that's the basic concept that the Alter Rebbe quotes from Aristotle.
Which is what the Rambam writes against in the Moreh Nevuchim.
Yep. Umedami bin Yoni Sakhariziv, and they imagine with their fake philosophy, as Maisa Hashem Vaisa Shemayim Lamaisa Enishatach Veloisav, that Hashem and people work exactly the same. Kishir Yotz, Litzarev Kalishuv, Ena Klitzarev Leidea Tzarev, that when a smith gets through making a cup and walks away, the cup stays around by itself. And it doesn't need the smith to constantly be banging on this piece of metal to keep it a cup.
To Master Chapter 2, and because it was created, we create ex nihilo, he's constantly creating the world.
Correct.
But the silversmith created it from
right. This is all chapter two from Shoyah Hamona. Shav Shyardu Shiyadov Masalkis Hamani. Even though his hands move away from him, who kaima atzmi, the cup stays around without the smith. So Tachmar Esenayim Ahevdul Hagadol Shabei Maisa Enishat Takvelusov. And so he says their eyes should open up. They got these like their eyes are glued shut. They should just open their eyes a little bit, because what are they trying to do? They're trying to compare a person and all of his schemes, and all that person is doing is taking a something and making it into a something else. What does a smith do? He takes a blob of metal and he smacks it or melts it and pours it into a whatever, and out comes a cup. So all he's basically done is just reshaped the thing. He hasn't created anything. All he's done is just change the form of the thing. Before it was a glob of metal, now it looks like a cup. And comparing that to what Hashem did, Shehu Yesh Ma'ayin, which this is a something from nothing, V'hu Pela Gadol Yesa Mekriyas Yamsuf, and the creation is beyond even the splitting of the sea. Now, that, I think we brought this up also before when we were learning Shoyah Harbona in chapter 7, that where he talks about the splitting of the sea. Okay, the splitting of the sea was very, you know, it's like, creating the world is greater than splitting the sea. Because what's splitting the sea? You take water and you push it off to the side. So what are you saying? And so the question actually becomes greater. You have an expression, which is Talmudic, that says it's kasha kakriyas yamta. If you want to say how hard is something, oh, it's so hard to do. How hard is it? It's as hard as splitting the sea. So who split the sea?
Hashem.
Hashem split the sea. Is there anything that's hard for Hashem? No. So what does it mean, hard, like splitting the sea? So it says that the sea splitting was a unique miracle. It was the only miracle that was ever perpetrated in this modus operandi, because all other miracles either involved engarbment in nature, meaning you could explain the whole thing totally and completely logically and naturally, and even write an equation on it, on the board for it. Wow. Yeah, I learned with a guy who's an engineer, a physicist. So I was talking about, I don't remember which miracle I was talking about. No, it wasn't a miracle. I was talking, there's the idea of a fire which comes out of a rock when you hit the rock. Okay? And the example is, this is an example which is given of where a person's intellect comes from in the essence of the soul. There's a place in the soul, it's not intellectual. You'd never even look at it to be intellectual. And yet, intellect comes from it. How? Well, how do you get a spark out of a rock? You could analyze the rock, and you're never going to see any fire in the rock.
It's only when you smack
it. Yeah, it's only when you smack it. Okay, so you said, but Rabbi, that's E equals MC squared. Okay, so I said, fine. Does that change it at all? Because you can write it on the blackboard. That doesn't change anything. So you can figure it out. You put it into natural terms. So in natural terms, so all there are miracles you could write on the blackboard. You could figure out how it happened. Okay, it doesn't make anything else miraculous. You have other miracles where the nature, the laws of nature are stretched. Okay, but, you have no time to make it to the plane, and you made it to the plane, and you have no idea. How did you make it to the plane? It was humanly impossible that everything like that should ever happen, that you should be able to get through security in that little time that it took you and run to your gate and get on the plane just at the right moment when before they're closing the gate, and you made the plane.
I'm thinking about the getting Yosef's coffin out of the water, out of the river.
How do you get oil?
You put a wood that would float.
Right.
Sank like a stone, and the metal floated like wood.
Right. Okay.
Hashem reversed, did something in the force of nature.
Okay, it was the force of nature.
But it was a little bit flip.
Yeah.
For us, it's impossible.
With Kriyas Yamsuf, the nature of water changed. Mm-hmm. So that's why it says it was difficult. Because to change nature, you know, we were talking about before at the beginning of the letter, you have a guy who's naturally a kasan. He's a natural hothead. That's unfortunately the way Hashem made him. Hashem made him a hothead. Can he change? Yes, with great difficulty. It's going to be very difficult for this person to change their nature and no longer be a hothead. You have a person who is naturally a stingy person. Can they change and become a generous person? Yes. And it's not that they're feeling coerced about, oh, shucks, I got to give them, because, it's the right thing to do. A person can actually change their nature to become a generous person. But it's difficult. It's hard to change a person, to control yourself, to chain yourself down. So that, okay, that's what's expected. A person's a stingy person. Person knocks on his door and says, I need charity. So what is this person going to do if he's controlling himself? He's going to reach into his pocket and say, no, Nebuchadnezzar says I have to give you. I'm giving you. I really would not want to give you, but no, the halacha stipulates I have to give you. I'm controlling myself.
You might even next time not say it and give it, and then next time.
Yeah, or not even be thinking it, as a matter
right,
of fact.
Right, again, someday he'll.
So give someday more. Maybe he'll say, I really do like it. I'm really upset that people aren't knocking on my door. I really want to give.
I didn't know that. I could get that far.
A person can change themselves, but it's like it's difficult to splitting the sea. You're talking about Hashem made this person this way, and the person says, that's not a good way for me to be. I'm sorry, God. And the person changes the way that they want to be, and God says, bravo. Hashem's not going to get upset if a person corrects a character flaw that Hashem put in them. Because why did Hashem put the character flaw in them? to correct. Okay, if Hashem would have wanted made perfect people, we wouldn't have had the Yetzirah, we would have all been born circumcised. I mean, you know, so. So he says, so it's difficult. He says, it's great. So splitting the sea is even greater than Kriyas Yamsuf. This is like, this is not a duh statement. Because, okay, creation is a something from nothing. But Kriyas Yamsuf is taking the something and totally and completely converting it to something else. Which that doesn't happen often. But he's going to say that, what he's going to say is even that Yesh Me'ayin, a something from nothing, is even greater than that. Because what happened over there? Asher Halach Hashem Baruch Kadim Azeh Kol HaLayil. The east wind was blowing a whole night. Vayivku HaMayim, and it split the water. V'ilu Pasach HaRuch Kerega, and if the wind would have stopped blowing for a minute, Hayu HaMayim Choyzerim and Igaren B'mayir Darkam B'tivam, then what would happen to the water? Go back to the way that it was supposed to have been going till now. As what did happen at the end of the night when all the Egyptians were inside. And it would not have stood up like a wall. Even though for 12 hours it's standing up like a wall. But that was because there was an energy being exerted which was overcoming the nature of water. Even though it is that this, the nature of water is created as a something from nothing, why does water flow? Because Hashem creates it to flow. It says, walls stand up. Do you need a wind to keep a wall standing? No. You don't need a wall to keep it. Walls stand up. That's what they do. But Hashem made it such that the water could act like a stone.
Liquids don't do that.
Master Beliruch Rak Teva Hamayim Aina King. The culture came a kavakami of Riyash Ma'ayan. And how much more so it is with the creation of a something from nothing. Shehila Maila Mahateva. That goes beyond nature. It's not even you're changing nature. You can't say that the nature of nothing is nothing. Because nothing has no nature.
Has no
concept. Nothing has so much nothing that we don't even know how what nothing even means. So you can't say that the nature of nothing is nothing.
We can't do math with it.
No. You get errors.
Mm-hmm. Same thing with infinity. We can't do math with it.
Yeah,
we'll try it and say you cannot.
Yeah. Once you're in that system, you know, so.
It's an idea. Upel yeis in the kriyas yam. So look, it's coming. She's talking about Hashem. Kaya chaber
yeish ma'ayin min ha-nivra. Yashuv ha-nivra la'ayin ve'efes mamut. So if it would be that Hashem would stop creating this thing for one instance, it would go back to the nothing from whence it came. And it would be as though it never existed before. To such that there would be no forensic evidence. When Hashem finally decides, after how many years of making this creation, okay, you know what, I've had enough with this creation. And stops creating this creation, he flips the switch, so then there will be no forensic evidence that this world ever existed.
That's mind-blowing, wow.
Yeah, if it would be possible at that point.
The things you dig up from the ground, Hashem continued to create.
Right. Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, those fossils. Hashem's creating those fossils. Yeah, sure.
Continuing to live.
So if it would be possible that there would be some kind of a creature that would walk by wherever the world was, that Hashem is no longer creating, they'd never know that there was ever a world there. Because the only reason why the world does exist is because Hashem is taking the nothing and converting it into a something right this second. And if Hashem stops converting the something, the nothing to a something, it goes back to being a nothing. And we don't even know what nothing means. Because he says, this is all a very one long sentence. Mayim would be a good
Chayos Arachnis. There is an end to it.
We'll go down to the dot. This ability that Hashem has the power of the potential is contained in that which is realized. Meaning, in potential, the world has an infinite number of possible permutations of what could happen in it. Mm-hmm. Hashem has limited that in the way that it creates the world, so that actually what happens is only one thing.
at that split
second. At that second, yes.
That shift split.
Yes, moment in time, only one thing's happened. Before the moment in time, what could happen?
Infinity. Next moment?
The present, there's only one thing could happen.
But the next moment is infinite again. Next moment from this moment that's one.
That was an old skit by George Carlin, who was like into words. I loved George Carlin. He had it, he said, there's a special moment coming up. Here it is, it's coming up, it's here. Oh, it's gone. And he says, how can you live in the moment if it's always going?
Shouldn't worry about it.
We're always expecting the future and remembering the past. We're never in the present. So it is this complete involvement of Hashem's potential, creating the world that it should actually be in this one specific way, that all that potential is now expressed when that one thing happens at that one instant. That's its life force. What is that? That's the vitality that Hashem is expressing through the 10 utterances, Shebehem Nivra Ha'olam, which the world was created, Afiel Erezu Agashni, Bechinas Daimim Shebah, and it's everything in the creation is enlivened by Hashem, even the inanimate objects, Vechayos and Vekiyam Hudvar Havaya, that they're bringing, brought into existence, and their sustenance is from Hashem doing it, Kimai Maris Hamalubish Bahem Akayim and Lehiyos Daimim Vyesh Ma'ayan. And it is this constant flow of godliness into any specific organism, which is keeping even an inanimate object in existence, so it should not revert back to the absolute nothing as the way it was. This is all back from chapter 2 and 3 already. That's why it says in the Kabbalah that inanimate objects have neshamas. Lahav, you could say, like the Indians have the spirit of the tree, you know, the spirit of the mountain. Okay, it's not the it's that that's pantheism.
The movie Pan. Forget the name of the movie now. It's about Pandora.
I don't know. Sorry. So, but what is it that says in the Kabbalah is that there's a spark in godliness, a spark of godliness in every single organism, which is keeping that organism going right this moment, specifically the way that it is being created right now. So that's where we get up to. This is where we stop. We stopped at Ruchnius in the Hebrew. Behina is the last word in the line, and it's the first paragraph on the right side of page Kuf Lamed. Yes, which is 277, and to be continued.